Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. My guest today is a legendary musician and songwriter who hails from the land down under, New Zealand to be specific. He first hit the global music scene as a member of the pop rock group Split Enz alongside his brother Tim in the late 70s. When the band split, he put together a new one of his own. After several incarnations, they became known as Crowded House, one of the best-loved bands to ever come out of the Southern Hemisphere. They topped the charts in the US and around the world in 1986 with the sublime Don't Dream It's Over. A string of superbly crafted singles followed, including Better Be Home Soon, When You Come, and Something So Strong, to name but a few. For the last decade, he's worked solo, with a series of family members, and perhaps most famously as one of the newest members of Fleetwood Mac. But now he's back with a new Crowded House album, Dreamers Are Waiting. It's the band's first new record in over a decade, and it features help from bandmate Nick Seymour, longtime collaborator Mitchell Froom, not to mention his own sons, Liam and Elroy. I'm so happy to welcome Neil Finn.
I'm very happy to be here.
Oh my goodness, so much to ask you, but first and foremost, Crowded House are back. Dreamers Are Waiting is your first new album since 2010. Why now? What made you decide it was time for another Crowded House record?
Well, I'm restless by nature, so I do a bunch of stuff, you know, on my own and with various other collaborators. And in recent times, I've played quite a lot with my sons, Liam and Elroy, both of whom become my favorite musicians in the world. And there was this idea congealed in my mind. And I've played with Nick recently as well in a different context, and Mitchell in another show. So there was all these people from the past and people that deeply connected to Crowded House. And I suddenly realized that a 5-piece lineup of Crowded House with all of these people who really have some spiritual and soulful connection to the band might be a tremendously exciting thing and might offer great potential. And I kept also coming off the back of the Fleetwood Mac tour, I had a newfound appreciation for classic bands and how they can be reimagined. And, you know, no band more so than Fleetwood Mac and still maintain that incredible charisma and meaning for so many people.
What is it like? You mentioned making music with your sons. I mean, that must be really special, that to have that familial bond, but also a musical bond. What's that been like for you?
Well, it came at exactly the right time. And we, as I said, Liam and Elroy have been developing their own skills for many years now. And as songwriters, arrangers, we've played together a lot. So in a way, that musical relationship has caught up with our parental, our father-son relationship and become, you know, almost independent of it. Certainly the instincts and intuitions of family count for a lot. But when we all walk into the room together, it's very much on an equal basis musically. You know, some people get the pleasure of playing with their kids. I would say it's very rare when it feels like an equal collaboration. It's always bound to be some hierarchy. Hey, I get the final say on my songs, you know, like if there's a decision to be made. But yeah, no, it's all for one for all in this band.
Speaking of it being a family affair, I understand that your grandson played a part in the track Whatever You Want, the lead single from the album. What role did he play? I understand he inspired the song in a way.
Well, he did. It was merely a fraction of an idea when he first heard it. It was on a demo and Liam was playing along trying to get some ideas for it as well. But he just started singing it. Jumping around and going, whatever you want. So we sort of figured that was a pretty good sign and it gave us some inspiration, really. He didn't come up with any other lines that I can remember, but he just caught on to that really fast. You know, nothing like having a small kid catch on to something to make you feel like you're onto something.
It's catchy, yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a great song and it feels so perfect for this really uncertain time that we're in now, this age of misinformation. And the video is so great with Mac DeMarco. He's watching television and the forecast is fear and anxiety.
Yeah.
Tell me more about the meaning of the song.
Oh, well, it obviously came out of the time. I mean, the concept of yes men, sycophants and people surrounding people in power is not a new one. I'm sure ancient Rome was full of them, you know, people that would tell Nero anything while Rome burned. But it's certainly very much of the time, you know, with politics. I don't even need to mention he who shall not be mentioned, but the level of gathering around those quite dishonest ideas and people being prepared to sell their soul to back them up and to keep their little part of the power structure is staggering, mind-boggling. So that song definitely arose out of that, watching this day after day on TV, people standing on stages telling barefaced lies and, you know, trying to keep their face straight. But it also occurred to us that it's the sort of self-deception that you convince yourself that everything's all right. And in Mac's case, he was asking the inanimate objects around the house to give him reassurance that he hadn't made a complete dick of himself the night before. That, of course, he probably had.
What was the expression I heard? Would sell your own grandmother to stay in power, I believe, was the expression I heard that stuck with me quite a bit.
Yeah, I probably should have tried to work that into the lyric too. It's a good line.
Well, tell me more about how did the music start for this album? How much of the album was made in lockdown? Did COVID impact the mood of the songs and the manner that you recorded them? Or did you have a healthy chunk out of the way before?
Well, we were fortunate because the timing on the record was that we recorded some rhythm tracks in Los Angeles all together in a room, as you know, traditional bands do. And most of the rhythm tracks came about that way, but we didn't get a chance to finish them in the studio because we went into lockdown. And so in some ways, a perfect opportunity for everyone to get into their individual pods in isolation and try ideas, which maybe you wouldn't get around to in the studio because you would think, oh, I'm holding everybody up here. We're just going to, you know, I don't know if this is going to work. But it enabled quite a lot of experimentation. So I'd say some of the atmosphere of the songs, it definitely emerged through lockdown. And some of the songs changed a little bit structurally in every way. There are a few, however, that are pretty very similar to how we put them down on the floor with live vocals and everything.
It sounds like that you and your Sungs and Mitchell were in the LA area, and I think Nick was, I believe, in Ireland. Was it hard to not have that chemistry and energy in the same room? Or did you adapt quite quickly to the Zoom and email sessions?
Well, like I said, we were fortunate. We had these tracks already, so we'd all shared those. The Zoom calls were tremendously helpful, and we were sending files to each other. And, you know, Mitchell would work on one song one day, and then I'd work on it the next. And we're making great gains and comparing notes. And Nick was sending surprising, you know, harp parts and French horn parts, places he has no business being. But because he was home, you know, he was able to try things. And some of them were really good. So I think it was quite, we used it well, and it was quite an important part of the creative process.
Your latest single was released a few weeks back, Playing With Fire, an amazing, infectious track. I love those Burt Bacharach-style horns that are in the background. It's so great. Can you tell me a little more about that song? I understand it came from more of a jam, right?
Yeah, we were jamming in those sessions at Valentine and came up with, the chords, I guess, and the basis of the melody. But I changed it around once we got out of the studio and into lockdown and did a bit of a major reconstruction job. It's a Frankenstein arrangement now. It's been compiled from different parts, but it really went through a massive transformation. I was delighted the way it turned out because it didn't suggest that whole sort of Bacharach swingle singers kind of vibe.
I love it.
Wasn't there to start off with, but it was a really nice discovery one day. And I did it with my voice and then sent it to Mitchell and he sent it back with all these beautiful brass parts on it. So yeah, it's uplifting.
Oh, I love it so much. I read, I'm not sure if this is true, and this is a serious music nerd question, I'm sorry in advance, that some of this was recorded at United on Sunset. Is that true?
Yeah, some of it was, yeah.
Legendary facility. Brian Wilson made Pet Sounds there, and I think Phil Spector did his Wall of Sound stuff there. What was it like working in a venue like that with such a cool history?
There is gravitas in those places that is really fun, and they sound great. They've got amazing gear, microphones, and the atmosphere definitely counts for something, for sure. So we went to both two really quite amazing studios. We started in Valentine, which was a place that hadn't been open since the 60s, but they reopened it about 4 years ago and still got the shag pile carpet on the wall. And it's a real timepiece. You know, what's the song? There's a few famous songs that have come out of there, but every LA studio from that area was churning out some good stuff. So we like recording there. I've got a studio back here in Auckland and it's a great place as well, but something about being away from your normal environment is good. There's not so many distractions.
Good point. Was it a relief in a way to have this project to focus on during this, you know, incredibly tumultuous, stressful time in the world?
It certainly was. We were very fortunate. We had each other. Doing a band record as well was fantastic because there was so much communication, collaboration going on. We felt like we had something between us that we could share, and we had a good laugh in the midst of it, you know, on Zoom. And something to see through that process. So yeah, in terms of who was suffering from the pandemic, we know, you know, thousands, millions were. So I don't want to be glib about the fact, but it was purely accident of circumstance. But we felt like we were quite lucky. We had a music to work on. We were safe. We were near the family. And, you know, I was climbing the Hollywood Hills every day and going for a walk to Griffith Observatory and seeing far more wildlife than I normally did. So, you know, there was an upside.
No, I was wondering about you for your creative process. Do you write every day almost like someone would do a yoga practice or jog every day? Or do you only write when you have something in your mind that you want to get out?
I feel I should write every day. I don't, but I'm in my music room here. So this is where I write. And I come in with the intention of playing the piano, and I do most days, but I get distracted with the affairs of the day and I'll end up, it's just a kind of a process of willing yourself into that mode where you're dreaming away and just playing like a child. But sometimes daily life, it's hard to deliver up that moment. But I do try and maintain a practice of coming in every day at least.
Are you superstitious about it at all? Are there any, you know, instruments that you feel like are a lucky instrument or a certain time of the day or only right after a cup of coffee or something like that?
Not really. I'm not a superstitious person. And ultimately, I just believe that inspiration strikes once you're working. You know, if you would rely on it to start working, you'd end up feeling a bit hopeless most days.
What do you do when you're stuck? Do you take a breather and come back to it, or just willpower and plow through?
It depends on how much energy I have on the day. Sometimes if you get a good idea, it's tempting to sort of go, whoa, and just luxuriate in that little idea and go off and have a break. And when you come back, you're intending to finish it, but it's really hard once you're out of that moment of, you know, moment of inspiration does strike. You sort of should try and mine it for as much as you can get at the time. It's hard to get back into the same frame of mind.
You mentioned that being on tour with Fleetwood Mac kind of put you back in the crowded Househead space. Did it influence you on a musical level? Did somehow playing those songs take you to a different place musically when you started composing for this album?
I think it influenced me musically, but I couldn't say specifically or point to a song where, you know, I'm evoking a Fleetwood Mac mentality. It just was more the thrill of singing somebody else's songs and singing high and outgoing manner. It definitely influenced what I wanted to do on this record in a more sort of holistic way, I suppose.
I mean, that must have been an unforgettable experience for so many reasons. But is there any like one lesson that your time on the road with them taught you that really sticks with you?
Well, I mean, they were meticulous about putting the show together musically. We had a 2-month rehearsal in LA. I've never spent that long. I've hardly ever spent that long on tour. But we could have done it in a month. But what I really appreciated about that, it gave the chance for the songs to the nuances of the records to be done really well. And we were usually on the fly with Crowded House, and we would do a 2 or 3 days rehearsal and be out. We'd have great gigs. But some of the nuances would get lost along the way. And I'm reminded now that Liam and Elroy and Mitchell, they all care about those nuances. And they've probably been listening to us playing for the last 10 years going, oh, I missed that little part. They didn't, not doing that little part, you know. And so they've learned them all. And the tour we just did of New Zealand was fantastic because some of these signature little parts are being played beautifully. And they're little, you know, the little hairs on the back of your neck moments. And it was the same with Fleetwood Mac. I really appreciated the level of attention to detail.
You mentioned going on a tour of New Zealand. I mean, where I am right now in the United States, I mean, the tours are still a pretty far way off, I'd say. How was that for you getting back out there?
It was amazing. You know, we obviously knew how lucky we were. It was, you know, every other musician we know in the world was shaking their heads going, you lucky bastards. So we made the most of it and we really enjoyed every minute. The audiences had a sense of, you know, wonder as well. I think they've navigated it well down here, our government, and we've been lucky. So we just grabbed that opportunity. It, right up to the last minute, it could have all fallen in a heap if there had been any cases. But we had like 8,000-10,000 people a night going nuts and all in a room together. It was just phenomenal. There's a live concert streaming event of it coming up in the next couple of weeks. And I'm really, really excited for people to see it because I think the band is on fire and I think there's an undeniable spirit, and we're playing so well. So yeah, if you've got even remotest interest in Crowded House, be prepared to be transformed.
Oh my gosh. And you mentioned, I meant to ask this early, you have Mitchell in the band full time. He played on your first three albums, but from my understanding, declined to join to pursue production work. How did you get him in full time now?
Well, the timing was right for him. And he wanted, you know, like we'd asked him to join way back in the day when he first did our record, but he was very intent on becoming a great producer. That he's had years to ponder now what a bad mistake that was. And when I asked him again, he jumped at it. And God, he's enjoying it, you know, being in a band, jamming in a room. He's a really good, instinctive, intuitive musician. And he's been in a role for years where he's had to make decisions all the time. And the first time we were jamming, when we don't have to make decisions, you just have to jam, he kept sort of stopping and going, well, we could make that first thing, the first verse. I'm saying, Mitch, just take it easy. We're not a record yet. We're just jamming, you know. And he's a really gifted jammer. And now he's loving that, you know. Can't stop him.
Oh, I love what he brings. I love the B3 sound that he has, and all of his keyboard parts are so great.
Oh, yeah. He's a master on the B3. It was such a joy to see the audience's faces light up when he started the solo and Don't Dream It So, because no one plays it like him, you know. It's been amazing.
It's so good. I was going to ask, is there a song that really you look forward to more than any else to performing each night?
You know, luckily the set that we put together for New Zealand was full of songs that I'm really love playing. There's so many, and every night maybe a different one comes through that you just revel in because you're actually hitting it in unusually good form. I really enjoy a song called Private Universe, which is off the album Together Alone. It's maybe not one of our most known songs in America. It's quite well known here. And it's got a quite a different groove, very atmospheric and mysterious, and has a big old drum and bongo workout at the end on stage, which was really exciting. And so I always used to look forward to that. It was kind of like the emotional high point of the set, right in the middle of the set, and the lights were, you know, spectacular to suit.
But what is next for you in Crowded House? What can fans look forward to this year?
Well, as soon as we can get over, we'll be coming to play. We'll be putting out a bunch of stuff in the meantime. As I said, the concert, the live concert, which is turned out incredibly well, is out within weeks. So hopefully people can tune in and get a taste of what we'll be doing when we do come. And I would think we're probably, we will be working on new material this year, given that we're still having to deal with a bit of isolation, not as busy a schedule out there in the general public. So yeah, we're going to focus on some new songs and try and get another album out by next year.
Amazing. My last question, has there been a silver lining for this last year for you? Something that maybe the slowing down taught you or made you a little more introspective?
There was some silver linings for us. And like I said, it was an accident of our circumstances to have some good fortune. But yeah, I mean, you notice when you have to shut down certain parts of your life, you notice the parts that you've been maybe neglecting or not fully appreciating. I'm lucky enough to have a wonderful couple of grandchildren and a family that's close by, and we all get on really well. So we've had really good family time. I would say we've all got closer together, and I'm appreciating being back in New Zealand. The good things about this place are more and more evident. Yeah, looking, another things, I'm not missing certain things as much as I thought I might. Like the plane travel, I'm not missing. Getting there is good, but, you know, the traveling and all the miles on the road and all that stuff. But it'll be interesting to see when we start up. I dare say I'll adapt to that quite well again.
Can't wait to see you back out there soon. Neil, thank you so much for your music and your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Pleasure talking to you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.